Support is provided in part by Conway Shield. Those who answer the call and risk it all for the safety and well-being of others deserve someone willing to give their all in return. Conway Shield is built on the shoulders of three service legacies. Customizing the nation's very best firefighting shields has expanded to providing the most effective technology, tools, and training for today's fire and law leaders. Learn more at conwayshield.com.
Welcome to the Leadership Under Fire, Humanizing the Narrative podcast. I'm your host, Jim McNamara. Today's guest is Tom Miller. Tom and I work together in Latitude 6. Tom is a former combat Marine and also a student at Columbia University, and certainly one of the most interesting young folks we have in the FDNY. Tom, welcome.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Tom, why don't we start from the beginning? Could you talk about the early years?
Sure. I grew up in the suburbs of Connecticut. Very nice town. Good family life. No nefarious stories there. I found myself, I think, profoundly bored at some point in high school. I was always a pretty good academic student until then, and I quickly fell off the curve there. And I think it was just the sense that I didn't find a lot of what was valued in that town important. I'm sure we'll get to my later academic experiences, but you know, it was my first taste of what happens at schools of that tier. It was a very good public school system. Is the intent is not so much to learn for curiosity's sake or understanding, it was to advance you to the next level. It was about learning for the test. It was about getting you into the good schools and advancing you that way. And that it became pretty quickly apparent to me I wasn't interested in that path, so I wanted to explore other options. The issue with growing up in a town like that is there's not really a clear path. It's not, oh, you go ahead and look at these guys, they work in the trades, or there's guys in the military, there's other options. It was really not, being in a school system like that, it wasn't about if you went to college, it was what level of college you got into. So I think my first experience of feeling like I enjoyed something and belonged somewhere was, believe it or not, working backstage theater, building sets, hanging the lights, doing stuff with my hands. And so I enjoyed that a lot. Didn't think I necessarily wanted to do it professionally, but it was my first taste of maybe there's something out there that's not a traditional college education. Like every five-year-old, I probably wanted to be a fireman, but it wasn't forefront in my brain then, and certainly not the military was anything I was thinking about consciously, although I did read pretty much every Tom Clancy book, so I guess it shouldn't be too surprising that's where I ended up. But at one point or another, when it became pretty clear we're getting to the end of the road here, so my senior year, I hadn't applied to any colleges, and there was a big question mark of what I was going to do come, you know, June, whatever, when graduation was over. I started going to the military recruiters. I remember I pretty much hit them all except the Air Force and the Coast Guard because they were never in their offices. I don't know if they just had their fill of quota or what, but went to the Army first. I took the ASVAB, which is basically the SAT version of for the military. Was a little off put by the recruiters themselves. They just kind of didn't strike me as somebody I wanted to be. So next stop was the Navy recruiter. And I actually made some inroads with the Navy, but they just kept pushing my ship date out. Originally, it was going to be August, and then November, then January. And here I was sitting in my hometown, living at home, all my friends off at college, and quickly was like, I want to be moving on with my life.
And what time frame is this now? What year?
This was 2005. I graduated June of 2005.
Okay. And then, so you're thinking about the military. Did the events of that September morning in New York City have any influence on your decision to look for the military?
They reinforced a couple things. One is the fire service, but also, you know, I don't remember a conscious moment after that of saying, okay, now I want to serve. But it was certainly now part of the background noise, so to speak, of what a life would look like of purpose, of doing something meaningful. In a way that it probably wouldn't have factored into my brain if that had never happened.
What really drew you to the Marine experience?
So the Marine was the last recruiter I saw, and it's actually a funny story because I hadn't even been thinking of it. I was supposed to meet my Navy recruiter, and they were not in the office, and the Marines of the Navy shared an office. And so the Marine recruiter very graciously offered to let me wait in his office. And I wish I could, you know, now we're talking 16 years, I guess, maybe a little less ago. But I wish I could be a fly on the wall for that conversation because I don't remember a word he said. I don't think it was much of consequence. All I remember is leaving his office. My Navy recruiter never showed up. Just thinking, I want to be that guy. That is the coolest person I've ever seen. So the Marines seduced me very well, and I couldn't stop thinking about it. And with the weeks turning into months and the Navy not getting back to me, I got a cold call from a Marine recruiter, a different guy. And I was like, oh, yeah, I would love to go, but I'm talking to the Navy. And, you know, if you guys could get me out of that, I'll go with you. And he actually didn't believe me. He thought I was just, you know, getting him off the phone. But so I called him a couple weeks later and said, have you made any progress? And he says, let me see what I can do. And about 3 weeks later, they had me standing on the footprints at Parris Island. So.
And so what was that first bus ride down?
It was a little anticlimactic because for whatever reason, I can't remember, the flights got messed up. Maybe it was weather. So we were at the connecting airport, I think Charlotte, and there was a group of us that the flight didn't go, so we didn't make it on time. And I remember sitting in there. They give you a file folder before they leave you. The recruiter drops you off at the airport in New York. And I think it had instructions. And here I am, 18-year-old kid. I'm using, you know, back in those days, I didn't have a cell phone. So I was using the payphone at the airport to call. And in my head, I think I'm calling, like, the Pentagon Command Center to let them know. Like, they must be tracking me. They know, you know, soon-to-be recruit Miller has missed his flight, and I got to keep these guys in the loop. Years later, when I realized kind of what that system was, I was calling some clerk who could care less, who it was whatever kid. but so, you know, we're stranded there in Charlotte, North Carolina. Some of the guys were older, and they want to go have a last hurrah. I think they get, you know, the compass and a hotel. So guys are going out. They're going to the typical, you know, bars and strip clubs and whatnot. But I'm just enjoying my last night of good sleep. But so the next day we get on the actual flight and we get down to Parris Island during the day, which I'm pretty sure normally you arrive at night to add to the little mystique. But we're not even in the full-size buses like you see on the TV when these little, you know, because everything's been shifted to the right. So when these little tiny buses and we get to where the footprints are, they're not even ready for us. So because I think we threw them for a loop. So we're sitting on the buses for 5-10 minutes. You could tell that, like, they're trying to find the appropriate drill instructors to start yelling at us. So it got off to a less than anticlimactic start, but it certainly shifted gears pretty quickly once they got their ducks in a row. Physically, figuratively, metaphorically, they strip you of your identity. You're running around naked. You've put all your civilian clothes and identity in a paper bag. They're dressing you from the bottom up in military issue stuff. And then I still remember the phone call. You line up on phones and you have to, they have a little card in front of you laminated of exactly what you're supposed to say. And I remember my dad answering the phone and I just start screaming this little, you know, speech I'm supposed to give and then hang up. And then it, you know, is off to the races for 13 weeks.
After that, what's the next step in the Marine process after boot camp?
Well, you get 10 days off. They give you boot leave and you go home. And I remember I got horribly sick. I think months later, I found out I had bronchitis. And my mom, I remember just crying. She's dropping me off at the bus station to go back down to the next phase of training because she's like, you know, how can this be? How can they let you go? But so the next step is Marine combat training. So they send, whether or not your job is infantry or not, they send everybody to some level of infantry training. If you're a non-infantry MOS, you go for, I think it was 4 weeks, down in Camp Geiger, North Carolina. So that was August. I spent four weeks very hot and humid digging foxholes in the North Carolina forest.
And then after that, what's the next step?
And then you go to your job training. So, you know, whatever your MOS was, you go get trained for that. And, you know, it depends on what it was, it is how long it takes you. So I was a forward observer. So you go to Fort Sill in Oklahoma for 4 to 6 weeks. Hard to remember. And you learn how to direct artillery. And then I went to the very nice Coronado California for the Naval Gunfire School, which again, 4 weeks or so. Then you hit the field, the fleet, as we call it.
Where was your first deployment?
My first deployment was with 2nd Light Armored Reconnaissance Battalion, which was based out of North Carolina. So after school, I got sent to Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. This was 2008. We got sent to Western Iraq, Al Anbar province, and I was part of the quick reaction force. So our job was to, you know, if other patrols, platoons got in trouble, we would leave the base and go kind of assist and rescue them. But for a little while there, just because things were in flux, they kind of made us our own patrol elements. So we went out. We called it the 5K. It was on a portion of the western desert. The main strip there is the MSR, the main supply route that went east-west. And it was an old Iraqi pumping station, well, I think water pumping station that we had taken over before I'd got there. And so there's a group of about 35 of us. That was the size of the quick reaction force that operated out there. We went on patrols like a normal unit, and it was about halfway through the deployment. They brought us back to the company element to act as a true quick reaction force.
Interesting. And how much time in total did you spend in the Marine Corps?
8 years. So I did 2 enlistments, so each one being 4 years.
And was all of your combat in Iraq?
No, I did. So I did that first deployment with 2nd LAR in Iraq. And then my next and last 2 deployments were to Afghanistan with 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines, which is an infantry unit.
And if you could share with us, I remember you telling a story that they needed your specialty somewhere, and there was a group of guys you ran into that were quite different from Marines.
Yeah, you know, what they needed was they needed JTACs in country. And so, you know, that was my job as a forward observer, as a JTAC. At one point later on, they just needed to source people from wherever. And so, you know, long story short, without going into details on things that may or may not have happened, I got to play around with guys who were a lot cooler than me. When you're the Marines of all the branches, very, very spit and polish, the high and tights, the uniform regulations, shave your face. It was a situation where I think back to when I saw my Marine recruiter for the first time, I thought he was the coolest guy. I was like, these guys are really cool. And I got to bounce around them for a little bit, and just because they needed a JTAC.
Excellent. So having completed, what now, 8 years of combat?
8 years, yeah.
Then you decide to, you know, you've done your service. God bless you. And then you decide to separate from the Marine Corps and begin your next phase of life. Was it difficult leaving the Marine Corps?
At the time, no. But it's funny because I think I quickly grew to regret or question the decision when I got out. But I think I was at a point 8 years in, you know, pretty high op tempo deployments, you know, never ending, making any type of work-life balance difficult. I was itching to kind of do something else, but I didn't really plan it out. I said, okay, I'm getting out. The GI Bill will get me to school, so maybe I'll go do that. Maybe I'll figure out, you know, at some point what I want to do. I had a bunch of ideas bouncing around in my head. But so when I made that, I made the decision pretty quickly, maybe brashly, but once I shifted gears and started that new life in college, I kind of found myself a little lost, not in a great mental headspace, you know, not having that sense of belonging anymore, of purpose. I grappled with that for a while, certainly for the years I was in college.
And if you don't mind, could you share with the audience what college you went to and what you studied?
I was fortunate enough to get into Columbia here in New York City. And even then, you know, coming back to the theme of not planning things out, I bounced around a lot of different fields of study in the sciences mostly till I landed on astrophysics, which is somehow what I graduated with a degree in.
It's still, to me, the single most amazing thing I've ever heard in a fire department. But how did you settle on that?
I think it was a combination of genuine intellectual curiosity about difficult things and maybe being a little bit of a masochist with wanting to endure 4 semesters of calculus and all the other maths that I didn't know existed, maybe to prove to myself that I could do it, and also just to, you know, again, it was driven by a desire to understand things that are complicated. And I also knew if I changed my mind any more times, I would be spending more than 4 years at college to get a degree.
It's remarkable, though. How many years out of high school were you when you started diving deeply into the math?
That was 9 years.
That's incredible. That's absolutely incredible to be that far removed, you know, from being involved in math and then jumping back in. That's incredible.
It certainly made it painful, but we got through it somehow.
So upon completion of your work in Columbia, did you decide to move any other areas?
I bounced around a lot of ideas when I was in school. You know, kind of had these two ideas in the back of my head, which is kind of why I came up to New York City and even pursued a education was, you know, the fire department was definitely a calling, but also I thought about working in federal law enforcement, whether that was FBI or something like that. And so I knew I needed a degree for that. And for any chance at the fire department, I would need to live in New York City. And it just so happened that the tests for the fire department coincided with about a year before I graduated, and things just kind of looked like they were going to go the right way for that. I actually also took the police test, and they were calling me even before I graduated, but at that point in time, I wasn't willing to leave school early for the police. So it just kind of worked out very well.
Interesting. And then so now you're in the pipeline for the fire department, and you start your first day at the academy. What was that like?
You know, I think I knew what to expect from any type of, you know, we bill ourselves as a paramilitary organization. And we were the first class of the list, so there was a lot of military guys. So I think we all knew what the game was, how to play the game of, you know, don't speak, you know, stand where you're supposed to stand, do what you're supposed to do, understand, you know, you're not going to win. They're going to find something wrong with you. So the first day, the yelling and screaming, I think some of us had to hold back chuckles just because we knew it was all an act. We knew the guys who were the drill instructors were just regular firefighters, and you know that this was going to end.
And then you finish the academy, and you're assigned to 26 Truck along with two other military members.
Yeah,
which an extraordinary group, I might add. So what was it like making that adjustment to the fire department?
It was great, honestly. It was, you know, all those kind of where my headspace was in college of not feeling like I was being useful or belonging to a group or really serving any purpose, that, you know, that this filled that void quite well, you know, especially what I missed from the military in terms of a brotherhood. I certainly had it. I joke, you know, I loved my time in the Marines. I look back at it fondly, but I felt treated better as a probie at 26 Truck than I did as, you know, an NCO in the Marine Corps. Felt like I ended up where I wanted to be.
Excellent. Were there any challenges in that first year that came up?
I think for me, the fire department, at least, you know, where I ended up, like I said, we call ourselves paramilitary, but we're not, in you know, except in name only. You know, there's a lot more of a expectation of stepping up, doing things under your own initiative. And not that I was lazy or anything, but I was very used to a rigid military structure of, you know, you do what you're told and that's it. You speak when you're spoken to, et cetera. In the fire department, you know, you kind of, not just other people want to see it, but it's for your own benefit that you should be finding things to do and asking questions and, you know, showing people that you want to learn. And that's something that, you know, I had to kind of break out of my shell. Of the Marine in me had to realize that, you know, it was kind of, I had to put this on myself to seek out that knowledge and to seek out, you know, to find things that needed to be done or things I wanted to learn.
Sure. And did you have any unusual incidents or really good fires that you had to call upon your Marine experience to help you get through?
You could put this in two categories. I mean, one, there's, you know, just the initial experiences. You know, I think it was my second tour ever. It was a night tour. We went to a first due second alarm at a Chinese restaurant and it was in the Ducks. Just like anything else, you know, you go through the academy, you think, you know, you don't know what to really expect when you get there. So I definitely kind of, before even, you know, I knew about human performance, mental performance, I tried to calm myself down on that first fire just by remembering, you know, okay, you've been in bad situations, you know, you can do this, even though maybe did I believe it or not. you know, because there's a lot of uncertainty. You didn't know really what you didn't know. So I definitely, you know, going through those fires, initially those first experiences, just trying to remember, you know, okay, I've been in bad, you know, hairy spots. I can handle this. And then I guess the other category is what I would say was objectively more complex fires. You know, that subway fire we had on 110.
Yeah.
Again, just, you know, drawing on things from the military, you know, that you're there with your team, that you have the training that, you know, just to stay calm.
And so recently, after a rigorous study, and I'll use air quotes, you passed the lieutenant's exam, and now you're on the list waiting to get promoted. What are your thoughts about, you know, moving up that rank and becoming an officer?
You know, it's an exciting prospect. I think it's I definitely have conflicting thoughts on it. On one hand, it would be a privilege to kind of be in that position. You're leading guys and gals. They're looking to you for guidance, and I think that's an exciting next step. You don't want to find yourself, you know, stagnating and being complacent. You know, so it's exciting to think about, you know, going into something new and growing on the job. On the other hand, you know, it's a lot of what I like about this job is the camaraderie and the brotherhood. And, you know, you get yourself to the next rank, you get out of that firehouse, you know, you have to bounce around, you kind of a little one step removed from the rest of the people. So, you know, there's still that brotherhood, no doubt, but it does, you know, with leadership comes responsibility, comes a little bit of a distance from the people under you. Also, there's a, you know, I don't know if you ever feel ready. You know, I'm just at 5 years on the job, but who knows when I'll get promoted. But, you know, will you ever really feel ready, especially to lead people under you who have significantly more time? I think this is something that, you know, I was never an officer in the military, but you have people come in as second lieutenants straight out of OCS, you know, pretty young, and they have to lead a platoon of people significantly more experienced than them. And that's certainly a challenge.
And where do you think you'll end up in the fire department? Will you continue to promote?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a ceiling of when it becomes a very different job, the way we're organized. Lieutenant, captain, you're in a company still. Even a battalion chief, you're doing runs, you're going, you know, you're still eating dinner with the guys. I think beyond that, you enter a whole different world. And not just because you're not working 24 hours and you're going maybe to Metro Tech every day or whatnot, but because, you know, you're no longer in what really drew me to this in the first place, was what I was missing from the military, that camaraderie. So, I mean, you know, who knows? We're talking about a point in time in the future that's pretty far off. So maybe, you know, my mind and my body will feel differently about getting out of the firehouse. But
I understand that. So let's switch gears and let's talk about your involvement with Leadership Under Fire. I mean, very shortly after you came to us, I was right on the phone with Jason, and I said, we've got ourselves, you know, an absolute star in the making. And then you had the opportunity to attend the Mental Performance Initiative in New York and then get involved with Leadership Under Fire. Can you talk about what that was like in sequence?
Yeah. So, you know, I had the good fortune of coming to 26. And so even before you had mentioned going to MPI, I kind of, without knowing the nomenclature, I'd already been exposed to a lot of the concepts, whether that was crawl, walk, run in terms of drill progressions or using video as game tape. So going to the course, it was, even before I got there, it was exciting because, you know, it was something else. It was not just being in the firehouse, in the sink, doing the dishes, checking the rig. It was exposing myself to another aspect of the job, something that appealed to kind of my intellectual curiosity for sure. And the week-long course, which was at The Rock because it was still during COVID, was a phenomenal experience. You know, we had a lot of guys, Fader and Grossman and other external people come in and just the concepts, some of which I'd been familiar with, like I'd read Thinking Fast and Slow before, but just to a level that I never really thought about. And also not just the theory, but how this applies in practice to what we do. It was really cool to see not just what people were saying, but that there was already people on the job talking about this and using it. So I came away from that experience very grateful that I got to go, and also thinking, okay, what's next? Because it was tough to go back to the firehouse, you know, still very new, and try to, you know, implement this in any other capacity, but just, you know, internally to for myself. But then I think it was pretty shortly after that I came down to Maryland with you all with Leadership Under Fire, and we set about, you know, setting out some strategic objectives of things we wanted to do in the future. And that's where the inception of the film room came, and the biometrics project.
And can you speak in a little more detail about the film room and some of the other projects you've been involved in?
To Jason's credit, because, you know, one thing you probably didn't hear me talk about my childhood was sports, and that's because I didn't play any. I was not, you know, I was a very lanky kid. I wasn't very athletic. You know, Jason, with his interest and background in sports, was well aware that game tape is something that's used widely and has a huge value in proving at that level. So he wanted to incorporate that into the fire service. And considering the fact that, you know, we don't go to nearly as many fires as previous generations do, yet we have a camera in every pocket walking by the fire ground. Every civilian who's got an iPhone can record, and they often do, especially in a place like New York City. There's thousands of citizen film, of YouTube buffs. You know, if you went to a fire in the city, it's probably been filmed. So if we compile this stuff and, you know, put it into different categories, that would be hugely useful for people to drill on. You know, it's like you said to me and other people say, you know, you can't go to a fire every day in reality, but you can certainly go virtually. You can watch a fire. The shortcoming being it can be difficult to navigate. You want to talk about or drill about a fire in a brownstone or a private dwelling or whatnot. You have to kind of go on YouTube or go on the internet and find a good clip, not something that's not very useful for what we would get from it. So what we've been doing is collecting those and putting them in a format which can be useful for people to drill on, and not just the video itself, but a framework for thinking about it that we've put up along with the film room of how you could use this tape, because it doesn't really serve you well to just start rolling the tape, because you run the risk of watching it all the way through, and then you're like, yeah, I would have done that. Oh, I could see where you made that mistake. But if you make that pause button your best friend, and if you're drilling with other people, you know, ask critical questions about what they would do then and why, and kind of make them run through the scenario in their head without seeing the answer on the film, you get a lot more out of it. So that's basically what we've been doing with the film room.
And Tom, what about the biometric piece and collecting that data and categorizing it?
Yeah, so again, kind of in the same vein, we have a lot of guys wearing some sort of biometric device that's giving them, you know, heart rate, sleep recovery, et cetera, and is potentially a huge resource in terms of data about what's happening to us physiologically and psychologically at fires and emergencies. The issue being we have no streamlined way of collecting it and analyzing it. So what we wanted to do was build a central hub where you can have your own account and you can kind of log in and make your own slide deck for every fire and emergency you went to. So you log in, you had a particularly difficult fire, or maybe it was just a run-of-the-mill thing. Maybe it was just something that you could establish as a baseline. You go in there, you can say where it was, what it was, the weather, because we all know that that affects physiological factors, input your biometric data from whatever you might be wearing, your resting heart rate, your max heart rate, how long you spent in certain heart rate zones, maybe, you know, your recovery, and then make notes on the operation from a, you know, a tactical standpoint, also a performance standpoint. So that's basically in the final stages of being tested with our inner circle here as just, you know, a central location for you to have this information for your own benefit, but also down the road for us to analyze in some meaningful way and extract trends from it.
And what other projects would you be working on, Tom, in the future?
We'll see.
Tom, as we begin to wrap up here, I'm going to hit you with a few speed round questions.
Okay.
Best book?
My absolute favorite book is called The Righteous Mind, and its subtitle is How Good People Can Be Divided by Politics and Religion. It's by a moral psychologist, I believe, out of NYU. And really, it for me explains this moment of time we're in, where we seem more divided than ever, where everyone's kind of in their own echo chamber, in their own tribe, and nobody wants to listen to each other and understand other people's perspective. And what it really boils down to, the theory he lays out is, you know, our morality, our whatever position we have on a policy topic, which politics does ultimately comes down to a choice of morality. It's not guided by your logical brain. He makes the analogy of the elephant and the rider being your logic and your elephant being your emotional. What's really happening is your emotions are subconsciously driving your gut reaction to an issue, and the rider is coming in after and trying to justify that opinion with logic that doesn't necessarily apply. He has this whole framework for the different dimensions everyone has of morality, and how some people have certain levels of one dimension, less levels of the other, and vice versa. And that's really where you see the breakdown between, in America, you know, Democrats or Republicans. And he extrapolates it to non-Western countries as well. But it really opened my eyes to seeing and explaining this moment in time and why we seemed so divided and unable to even give each other the benefit of the doubt to have a good faith discussion of any issues.
Interesting. Best movie?
Heartbreak Ridge. Clint Eastwood, Marines.
Of course. And the leader you admire most?
I think Bill McCraven. I didn't personally work with him, but just from what I've read and seen of him, would definitely be high on my list.
And you want to explain, for those who don't know, Admiral McCraven?
So he's retired now. He was a Navy SEAL officer. I think he was at one point the longest serving SEAL or the most senior SEAL. And he ended his career as the commander of either JSOC or SOCOM, but he was the commander for the Bin Laden raid and some other pretty high profile stuff.
What was it about McCraven that you found appealing?
I found, you know, for me, I think it was that he was widely respected, and he trusted the men on the ground. I think is from what I know of his leadership style is he. You know, I think that's hugely important. And one of my other, favorite books, but books I really like is The Mission, The Men and Me by Pete Blaber. He talks about this. You know, we live in a world, and as technology increases, commanders have more and more of an ability to micromanage, and they have, it's easier for them to dilute themselves into thinking they have more situational awareness than the guy on the ground and to take over. And he certainly, McCraven, you know, trusted whoever he had on the ground.
Very, very maneuver-ish. I'm surprised you didn't use the John Boyd book.
You could use that as well. Yeah.
Tom, it was a pleasure having you on the Leadership Under Fire, Humanizing the Narrative podcast. And you just continue to impress me, you know, every day. Just when you think you're informed or well-read, and you come up and you meet Tom Miller, who was at one point was my probie, and he's just absolutely a force to be reckoned with academically, and someone whose intellect will improve everyone around them. And to think that he's going to focus and help push this department and this fire service to another level is beyond awesome. And Tom will also at one point, along with Joanne Mariano, will be part of a research endeavor which for the next 10, 15, 20 years will absolutely just mind-boggle the American Fire Service. Tom, this was an absolute pleasure.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The Leadership Under Fire podcast provides a platform that helps to prepare performance leaders to navigate the moral, mental, emotional, intellectual, and physical rigors in high-risk and ultra-competitive settings by developing strength of mind, body, character, and critical thought. For more on this, visit leadershipunderfire.com.